Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems. On the island of Maui, they've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now, become a snack subscriber, and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com, that's MauiNuiVenison.com, and use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is a production of the Bear Grease Podcast called the Bear Grease Render, where we render down, dive deeper, and look behind the scenes of the actual Bear Grease Podcast. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore.
I think fly fishing is real pretty to watch.
Fly fishing is captivating.
It is.
You guys are missing out.
It is really pretty to watch.
I feel like you're a liar, Clay Newcomb.
Yeah, why? It's beautiful.
Because I can't tell you how many times I've heard you say, you know what I'm really drawn to is people who have a passion for something, have an identity. And I talk about fly fishing all the time on this show, and you just blow over it like it's not even a thing.
Wrong passion.
Apparently, that's the wrong passion. You're attracted to people who have passion
It's really cute when people like fly fishing. I think it's really cute.
Yeah, whatever.
That's why people say they can't do it, Josh.
No, Josh. No, I respect your passion for fly fishing. Absolutely. Now, does that mean that I want to talk about it all the time?
You should.
I want to hear you talk about it.
He wants you to talk
about
it.
I'll let you talk about fly fishing as much as you want.
In my car, driving home from the render.
What would you say about fly fishing?
I would tell
you all about it. Let's just say you had the floor.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's just
say. What would you say?
I would talk about, first of all, the places that fly fishing takes you is one of the things that I like the best about it.
I like that.
The beautiful locations, environments that you get to. One of the things that I love about fly fishing is, especially trout fishing, is being in cold water.
Yeah.
When it's 100 degrees and you're standing in 48 degree water, it's like you are tasting the extremes at one time.
You can do it in a long
It's amazing.
Shirt.
I like the idea.
It's amazing. And then watching, I mean, ideally, a nice dry fly cast where it lands out there so delicately.
Yeah.
And then seeing a monster brown trout. Just go up there and slurp that thing in there, and you react and set the hook, and that fish just goes crazy. But you're usually fighting that fish on a very fine tackle, so you know the fight's on for at least 10 minutes.
Really?
Can be with a big one. I mean, it's a thrilling
beautiful,
feeling.
Moving, compelling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much more time do I have?
You can have the whole podcast. Hey, welcome to the Bear Grease Podcast. Welcome to the Bear Grease Podcast. You just heard the poetic voice of Josh Lambridge Spillmaker.
Never been accused of that.
Good to have you, Josh. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Brent Reeves. Always looking sharp.
Those look like fresh overalls.
Yeah, these are good.
Pretty fresh.
Nice. And that new knife.
Oh, he cut his pants. He cut them.
Oh, man.
With that new knife, with that new meat eater knife.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, I think it is sharp.
Mm.
Right there. Just barely touched it. Just like a ding.
Like a scalpel. Kinda
like a dry fly floating across the White River.
If it would have hit it any harder, it would have took half my leg off. The thing's sharp.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
To your left, Isaac Neal,
yes,
producer
sir.
assistant producer of the Bear Grease podcast.
Assistant to the regional.
I commented on Isaac's attire when he walked in. I was really proud of him. Yeah. He really looks like a redneck.
I got so ashamed and embarrassed of
your foot gear?
No, the tattoos. Oh. I had to cover them. I scheduled a laser tattoo removal.
I forgot you even had tattoos.
Well, just to paint a picture, I got some nice boot cut jeans on, a pair of cowboy boots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. And what? How would you describe your shirt?
A camo hat.
This is like a...
It's vague Hawaiian.
It's kind of...
Vague Hawaiian. Yeah. That's good, Brent.
It's kind of in the vein of Hawaiian. Like Willie Nelson, kind of like redneck, kind of hippie.
Yeah, yeah. And then Isaac's got hair down to his navel. Yeah. To Isaac's left.
You don't have to exaggerate.
To Isaac's left, my lovely wife, Misty Newcomb.
Hello.
Misty, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Clay. It's so great to be here.
It's really a big deal. I don't know if y'all realize what a big deal it is to have Misty. This is a very busy woman. I mean, she's like scheduling these things in, like negotiating with other people about this time.
Do you have her people, your people call her people?
I can't. I don't even talk to her. I talk to her people.
But it's like, what's great is we live in this like isolated world of social media where you're a big deal, right? And she's your wife, but like in the real world where things actually happen. You're Misty Newcomb's husband.
Hey, we were trying to film a little short
just depends
clip
on what context you're
of
in.
Making gravy. And there's people knocking on the door and Clay's looking out the window. He goes, there's a delivery truck out here. I wonder what that is. They leave and we start filming again. And Isaac's like, here comes another truck, another guy. There's a bigger delivery truck. Clay says, we got to take a break. I got to find Misty. I don't know what's going on here.
Turns out there was a wedding at
her house.
There
was a wedding coming.
So, Misty, thank you for taking time out of your schedule. Mm-hmm. And then Gary Newcomb, whose schedule is just wide open since about 2012.
Correct.
And good to have you, Dad.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for coming up.
Yeah, enjoy
it. Gary Newcomb is the most preppy dressed of us all. Looks like he's going golfing. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, a little embarrassing, but it's all right.
That he's going golfing? Or that he's better
all
dressed?
All of the above. I'm kidding, Dad.
He's a Renaissance man. He's a Renaissance man.
Yeah. So, great man.
And then?
Who else? That's us.
That's all.
Our interview.
I got to go first because of the fly fishing.
Yeah, that was just like a little bonus
about
deal.
Time.
We're gonna cut that out. So, Isaac, cut out Josh's.
So you better circle back to Josh.
And Josh.
In case it gets cut out, Josh Lambridge.
Yeah. Hey, I was in the Pacific Northwest this last week, and people were they started talking about the land bridge that people walked. Like, you know, that they said, you know, they theorize it's the first.
Right.
Anyway, and I was like, oh, I know all about the land bridge. My friend's mustache looks like.
Do you know that I was born in the Pacific Northwest also?
I knew you had some ties there. I actually was trying to figure that
out. Seattle, Washington.
I didn't know that.
Almost accidentally.
You were raised in Michigan.
Which part?
So I assume you're of European descent, just based upon what I know about you. Did your family come over the land bridge, just went backwards?
Not that I know
of. Most patterns of migration of Europeans?
I actually had a shattering life moment. A couple months ago, my mom got suckered into one of those 23andMe kind of things.
Oh,
and I
no.
found out that my German heritage came in through Canada.
Really?
Oh,
they immigrated to Canada and then moved into Michigan.
Those
interesting.
Yep. We've got some pretty fun family stories surrounding 23andMe. I mean, really, scandals. It's pretty fun.
Hey, not to like steal the vibe of having fun.
Take it away.
But Josh and I are really good friends and have been for decades. Josh, tell him a little bit about your dad.
So my mom and dad got married in 1975, and my dad was 19, my mom was 22. And just a couple months after my parents got married, they were very happily married. My dad had a framing crew, and he'd come home and he'd say, man, I'm really tired. And this was in Michigan. And he'd come home, fall asleep in the bathtub. I mean, just at 19, 20 years old. Well, he went to the doctor and found out.
And your mom was like, what's...
Yeah, what's going on? Seems like, you know, you're in the prime of your life. They did some blood work and found out that he had some very, like, extremely low hemoglobin levels. Come to find out, he had a very rare disease called aplastic anemia. And the only cure was a bone marrow transplant, which was... There were two research centers in the United States that were doing research on bone marrow transplants, one of which was in Seattle.
Okay.
And so my parents actually, they called and said, if you want a bone marrow transplant, be here on Monday. And it was a Friday.
Really?
Oh, so wow. My parents literally packed up in 2 days and moved to Seattle. And my dad had experimental chemotherapy and a bone marrow transplant. His sister was a donor. And right after I was born while they were there. 3 weeks later, we left and went back to Michigan. And my dad got home, and one of the things he loved to do was water ski. And he just begged my mom. He said, man, I feel really good. I really want to go water skiing. And she said, I don't want you to. So he's 20 years old. He decides to do it. Catches a cold. What aplastic anemia does is it destroys your, you can't produce white blood cells anymore. Right. So you have a very compromised immune system. And he caught a cold. It turned to pneumonia. Ended up in the hospital. The doctor said, the family needs to come down here and say your goodbyes. A couple days later, he's better. And seemed to make a rebound there. A couple weeks later, he got sick, turned to pneumonia. Same scenario. Come down, say your goodbyes. He's not going to make it. And my mom actually, I found some, going through some old stuff from my dad, I actually found a journal of my mom's. And my mom prayed and she said, Lord, by my anniversary, make me a widow or make me a wife. Either heal him or take him because this up and down is too much for me. And he actually passed away 4 days before their first anniversary.
Wow.
And so I was raised by a single mom till I was almost 12. And but I tell you what, I have we've talked about my mom on this podcast before. She's an incredible woman.
She really
strong,
is.
Determined, hardworking. I learned an incredible work ethic from my mom. The hostess with the mostess.
True.
And man, it's shaped who I am to this day. And I'm real grateful for what my mom invested in me as a child.
Awesome. I've always loved that story.
You know, I was really impacted, and I don't want to jump ahead too fast, but I was really impacted by Mark Kenyon's story about his lucky streak.
Oh, yeah.
About how he, you know, killed the deer, got the job, and then met his and got together with his wife. Tell you what, that's a pretty good lucky
streak. How does
that
connect to you, this, what you're talking about?
I'm just talking about the having a godly woman in your life and a good, strong woman. Man, is a pretty awesome thing.
Yeah.
Those are the things that really matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Now we know a little bit more about Josh Doyne.
And I like to fly fish.
And he likes to fly fish. It turns out this episode's all about Josh.
Is it appropriate Finally. To talk about the Just time kidding. Deb Summers saved your life?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, is that taking it too far off the rails?
Because
she 100%
well.
Did
Go
save
ahead.
Your life.
Yep.
I get a call one
she
time.
She raised Josh and saved my life once.
I don't even remember what happened, but we were at the Spillmaker. Josh and Christy and I were together. Clay was...
Well, do you want me to tell how I got there?
I definitely wanted you to tell the story.
Okay.
That's why I started to tell the story.
I was
hoping
I was going to the
he would take
Jasper,
it away from me.
I was going to the Jasper Elk Festival. I was going to the Jasper Elk Festival in probably like...
Jasper, Arkansas.
2010 or something. And I was manning a booth for the Arkansas Black Bear Association, which was an organization that I ran and everything. And man, I woke up real early, had to be over there by like 7. It's like a 2 or 3 hour drive, and just woke up real early, went over there. And on the way there, I remember where I was at. I could take you on the road there before you get to Jasper. When I looked out the window and could see this big vista, and I remember just thinking, I feel absolutely terrible. Like it was just like, I just was like, I feel like I'm about to die. But I committed to be here, and I was just like, I'm going to go. So I went. And I get to the Jasper Elk Festival and set up my little booth, get everything set up.
The pop-up tent.
Yeah, and just and about, you know, 8:30, people start showing up. I'm standing out in the middle of the road. They have the square blocked off. I'm standing out in the middle of the road talking to some friends that I knew from Russellville, Arkansas. And they were a real sweet couple, and they hadn't seen me in a long time. I had just greeted them. Just like, hey, hadn't seen you guys in a long time. I gave them a hug, and I'm talking to them, and I just go, I feel absolutely terrible. And the next thing I know is nothing.
Gravity.
So pause.
I went down.
And so Connie calls me. And I'm with us. This is an important piece of the story. Connie calls me. Well, I've never met Connie. And Connie calls
me. She gets my phone and she says,
she just looks for my name. Uh-huh. So I've never met her. She calls me, though. And I'm with Josh and Christy. And they said, hey, that's right over there by where Deb.
But that story's not over yet.
I know. That's why I'm trying to tell it.
Settle down.
he, and Clay, they want to take him to the hospital and he won't. he doesn't want
to
go.
They're like wiping me down, and I come to and I go, I'm okay. I just get me back to my booth. And so I stand up, and they're like, whoa, whoa. And you know, everybody's like grabbing at me. I'm like, I'm okay. Don't worry. It's okay. And I say, I'm just going to walk back to the booth and sit down. And so I go to walking through this big crowd of people. And I mean, just next thing I know, I'm in an ambulance. I hit the ground again. And that is when Connie called you.
So, okay. So that's when Connie called me.
Two times fell in the street.
Two times passed out. Josh and Christy are with me. They get on the phone while I'm on the phone with Deb. And, or they call Deb, who is about 15 minutes away. I don't know how it happened, but in the way I remember it, I am on the phone with Clay on the same interchange. Connie gets the phone to Clay, and I'm saying, Clay, let him take you to the hospital. And
I'm in an ambulance.
He's in an ambulance, and he won't go to the hospital. And I don't know what's going on, except for Clay just passed out two times. And all of a sudden, the crowd parts. like the Red Sea. And the crowd parts, and Deb Summers has figured out a way to get, this is Josh's mom, has figured out a way to get her car in the no parking zone and has gotten the entire crowd moved. In my mind, Deb picked, I wasn't there, right? So I don't remember it, but in my mind, I can hear Deb picking up, like showing up.
Like a baby bird.
In like 60 seconds, showing up, parting the crowd, getting her car parked illegally, picking Clay up like a groom would pick up his bride. That's how I had it. Took him to his house.
It was kind of like that.
Got to the house, you was like, how far away is it from
us? It's probably 30 minutes.
When I got to the house, Clay was eating. He had like a feast in front of him and was laying velvet.
All his favorite movies on VHS.
It was hilarious. It was
popsicles.
Yes, the whole nine yards. And that is classic Deb. And to this
what she did is they put me in an ambulance and they're like, sir, we're going to take you to the hospital. And I was like, I will not consent to going to the hospital. I'm not going to the hospital. We didn't have health insurance.
Yeah. We're self-employed.
Like, yeah. I was like, I'm not going to the hospital. And they're like, sir, are you sure? And I'm like, yes. And they made me sign this paper before I got out of the ambulance. So I got out of the ambulance, and I was like, I'm going to walk to my booth. I get to my booth and sit down, and everybody's like checking on me and stuff. And then Deb walks up, and she doesn't even say hi. She just goes, Clay Newcomb, you get in my van right now. She stuck her finger out. That's what I remember her saying.
She said,
Clay Newcomb, you get in my van right now. And I just said, yes, ma'am. And I went and got in. She opened up the side door of the minivan, and she had stuff in there.
Oh, I'm like sure she
cold
did a cooler.
Baths and food and drinks.
Yeah.
And she was like, lean that chair back, and you sit there. And so we went to her house and just had a great afternoon.
Classic.
Turns out I had ehrlichiosis.
Do you know what that is?
Tick-borne. It's the most common tick-borne illness in this part of Arkansas.
Yeah, my dog.
Brought over by the working dogs from Vietnam. They got it in the jungles of Asia,
really?
Gary Newcomb. Huh. You may have brought it back.
May have mailed it
for
over.
For all we know.
Hmm,
do you have any ticks on you when you came back from Vietnam?
I had a few.
No, so all the service dogs that came in from Vietnam, most of them were channeled through Fort Chaffee. And they brought these dogs back. And if you look at a heat map of ehrlichiosis, somebody will fact check me on this and they'll learn that I'm right. If you look at a heat map of ehrlichiosis in the United States of America, there's like a sunspot about 100 miles in any direction from Fort Chaffee, Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Really?
Yeah,
really?
And that's what they say. That's what I was told by a veterinarian who I believe was telling
not
the truth.
Lying to you.
Public service announcement. If you have flu-like symptoms in the summer and you are outdoors a lot, it took forever to get an accurate diagnosis of what was going on. And once we did, we were able to move forward. But that was a tough summer. Clay was, sick. It was bad. Like, couldn't stand up without passing out type of bad sickness. They gave you antibiotics.
Yeah, it was just standard treatment. But pretty much Rocky Mountain spotted fever, Lyme's disease, ehrlichiosis, and now alpha-gal.
It's the worst.
The big ones. Yeah, it's bad news, man.
Yeah.
Bad news.
I had Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
Okay.
And a guy walked in my office, and he is a friend of mine. He just started telling a story about getting a tick-related disease and how he felt. He just went, I one, two, three, four, five things happened. Then I got up, got in my car, drove to the clinic, went in. They gave me this, this, and this. And so, I mean, like 3 days later, one happens, two happens, three happens. I think, okay, I'm going to the clinic.
Like not till after he told you about
it? Yeah, I mean, it was just like luck, bad luck, which we're going to talk about that.
Oh, nice segue, so Gary.
Good luck that he came into your office.
Yeah, because I might have laid there a day or two thinking, you know.
And 25 years ago, people didn't pay as much attention to tick-borne illness as they do now. I think there was a time period when doctors were just like letting people die for having tick-borne illness.
Well, it's a specific test they got to test for, because my brother had it, and when he was finally diagnosed, I came in from Missouri turkey hunting one year. It's like, man, I feel like terrible. You know, I feel like I've been eaten by a coyote and crapped off a cliff. It is terrible. And he says,
Summers come by?
He said, no, I wish you had. He said, you sound like you got it, man. You need to go. And they did that specific test, and sure enough, that's what I had, was like what Gary had. Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and it was tetracycline for breakfast and supper for a week or two, and then it was gone.
Yeah.
We got an accurate diagnosis because someone he was with in the woods, he was doing work with, and that guy got a diagnosis. And that's when we called the doctor and said, is it possible that this is what he's dealing with? And it was like game changer. But for, I don't know how long he would have. And I mean, it was really bad.
Do you get cured with medicine, or is it just?
I think it just kind of dies down. I think you'd.
Well,
I think
it's different for some, because I hear about people with Lyme's disease, and that seems like a little longer term.
Yeah,
it was much longer term than what you had.
So, I think this is a good point to get into what I really wanted to talk about today, which is a pretty serious. It was a pretty unique time for the Bear Grease podcast, because We're going to institute something that has been in my heart for a long time, and I believe that this will persist through time and be really important. We're going to institute the Bear Grease Hall of Fame, an official Bear Grease Hall of Fame, and I'm going to get a plaque of some sort made, and like, you know how you can make plaques that have room for more little.
Oh yeah,
and you put the tags.
They have
little tags. Yeah, so you make
everlasting.
You get a big plaque, and it starts off with just small things. So here's what we've got: some business, like actual business, to take care of, and that is to talk about. And basically, I'm going to pronounce who is already in the Bear Grease Hall of Fame, and then
when the plaque goes up, it'll already have a bunch of names.
Oh yeah, but then we're going to vote on someone.
Okay,
okay. Are y'all with me?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And so I think that it is a given of who would be, and I want to get your. So I'm going to make a list of people, and basically I'm going to ask for your yay or your nay, and they will be officially put into the Bear Grease Hall of Fame.
Agreed.
What do you call it if you do something from before?
Retroactive?
Retroactive.
I think you're thinking
grandfathered in.
Brent, put that Lodge Caster and Skillet right here, if you don't mind.
And by the way, it's called a perpetual plaque, not an everlasting plaque.
Perpetual plaque.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let me see that bone. That's big bear thigh. Okay, I would like to officially make the proposal to the group that we induct, number one,
Daniel. Is this in order of importance?
Nope.
Okay.
Just what we've done before.
Okay.
So from here on out, if we have someone that's eligible, we'll induct them like right after, like when it's apparent.
Got it.
You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
So I would like to nominate for induction into the Bear Grease Hall of Fame Daniel Boone.
Second.
Hold on. We're going to do this in one group.
I always wanted to do that.
Daniel Boone. Yeah, can I get a second?
Another one? That'd be a third.
Okay, Daniel Boone, Warner Glenn.
Mm. We're doing them all at once.
Roy Clark.
So it's all or none.
That's right. This is a batch.
Okay.
Roy Clark, James Lawrence.
Uh-huh.
I'm in.
George McJunkin.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And Frederick Gerstacker.
Whoa.
Definitely.
It's a big
list. That's six.
I'm on board.
Okay, so Frederick Gerstacker would have been in.
You want to vote or what?
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All the nays, say nay. It's official.
So let it be written.
Daniel Boone, Warren Glenn, James Lawrence, and Frederick Gershocker and George McJunkin are now officially in the Bear Grease Hall of Fame from here on out.
How often will new inductees be made?
There's no schedule. But what I want to do right now is I would like to nominate. So this is how we'll usually do it.
Okay.
Point of clarification.
Yes.
Do the living inductees get a benefit, like a gift certificate to Golden Corral or something? Mm.
They should.
Ooh. Okay. We'll table it.
Chaps. Yeah.
Revisit it at the next render.
Great.
Okay.
Okay. I would like to nominate for the Bear Grease Hall of Fame, Orly Province.
Oh.
I feel like there's some, I feel like an inductee into the Bear Grease Hall of Fame has characteristics that would be evident and seen by all, but often intangible and indescribable. Because it's not one thing that these men did.
Mm-hmm.
It is connected to character. It's connected to longevity. It's connected to connection to the land. It's connected to grit.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
It's connected to humility.
Mm-hmm.
You don't come banging on the lodge cast iron skillet asking to be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
These men didn't ask to be in the Hall of Fame.
That would be distasteful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I feel
they have to embody the values of the Bear Grease podcast.
I feel like Orly Province, I mean, just the guy, he's there.
Mm-hmm.
Any public commentary in support? Would anybody like to make a speech in support of this?
Yeah, I think he embodies everything that a lot of people aspire to be. He did something great. And if you'd never know it unless you ask him.
Yeah.
And then it was probably like pulling teeth. You know, it wasn't like he went into some big, long, elaborate story about how he killed that deer. He just slipping along the bluff and looking down there, and there he was.
That's right.
Yep. I second.
Second from Brent Reeves. All right, all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed.
All opposed, say nay.
Nay. Oh. What? Just kidding.
What just happened?
Just kidding.
You're going to recant that?
Yep.
Okay. Orly Province is now inducted into the Bear Grease Hall of Fame. So now there's 7 inductees.
Here, here.
So we'll just start from there.
Somebody write that down.
Yeah, we'll get it written down. So to dive into...
Where are you going to put this plaque? There's no room in here.
Yeah.
We're running low on wall space.
Yeah, we're running low. We'll find a place. We'll find a place. Excellent. Here, well, I think that to start off our conversation about this podcast called The Unusual Whitetail Streak of Orly Province, we need to sing our song. So lucky for you guys, we have an original ballad written about Orly Province that I'd like to sing. I'd like to ask Josh and Misty to accompany me on it. So I wrote this song just this week. I just felt inspired to write a song about Orly Province because I like the guy so much. So this is what I came up with. Misty Newcomb on the banjo, Josh on the guitar, Brent Reeves on the lodge cast iron skillet with a bare bone. On the eve of the Great Depression, in June of 1927, high on the mountain he was born, shucking corn, his shoes were worn, and his mama mourned. Became a man at age 16. When his daddy died, the family cried, and his brothers went to war. Orly Province was an Ozark man. Fried deer meat in the cast iron pan. Loved the fiddle and Bill Monroe. Skidding logs, oak timber fall, the thunder roll. In 1946, got a good horse, no remorse, cutting cross ties. 35 cents a piece will starve a man, callous his hands, but he loved the land. Working in the timber, He longed for the cold days of November. Back to the chorus. Everybody. Ori Province was an Ozark man. Fried deer meat in a cast iron pan. That's right. Loved the fiddle and Bill Monroe. Skidding logs, oak timber fall, the thunder rolled. In 1965, the north wind blew, the storm clouds grew, and the beast hunkered again the bluffs. That's right. Ori came a-slippin'. When the shot rang out, a great buck went to trippin'. He went and got Eugene. They found 28 points that would hang a wedding ring. That's a good line. But that wouldn't be the last. When not 2 weeks had passed, his muzzle sang another blast. Back to the chorus, everybody. Ori Province was an Ozark man. Come on, Isaac. Fried deer meat in a cast iron pan. Loved the fiddle and Bill Monroe. Skidding logs, oak timber fall, the thunder rolled. Last verse. Some would say it's luck, but I would say, well, shucks, he's a bluff-hunting man. He saw a Droctine buck, shot 9 times, blurred the lines, and the big buck fell. He carried 18 points, acorn fed, limestone bred, and an Ozark legend was born. All right.
That was a good one.
All right.
Yeah, that's good.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. I don't know if you stopped in at an O'Reilly lately, but I use one because we have one right not too far from my house. People there are super helpful. I don't care if I'm getting boat batteries, car parts, whatever. Love those guys. They got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you don't have to worry if you're in a jam. The team at O'Reilly Auto Parts can test your battery for free, in or out of your car. If it needs to be replaced, they'll help you find just the right battery for your vehicle. If you need your windshield wipers replaced, a brake light fixed, quick service, they'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. Whether you are a car aficionado or an auto novice, you will find the employees at O'Reilly Auto Parts to be knowledgeable, helpful, and best of all, friendly. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things do-it-yourself auto. You can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater.
Ready to win Mother's Day and cement your reputation as the best gift giver in the family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. She'll love looking back on these memories and seeing what you're up to today. Even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep updating mom's frame with new photos, so it's the gift that keeps on giving. And this is not a joke. Juju Newcomb has an Aura frame, and we share photos, and they're incredible. Also, my mother-in-law has one. We have them. They truly are really good, really high quality. The Aura frame is easy to set up. It takes just 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app. It also adjusts the display depending on light levels in the room to maintain the true color of your photos. For real, the digital screen is amazing. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame when you use code BEAR, B-E-A-R, BEAR. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code BEAR at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. Sport Dog is the most recognized brand in the hunting dog training industry.
Born in 2003 in Knoxville, Tennessee, Sport Dog was forged by a passionate group of hunters and dog trainers who intimately understood the challenges of the field and the special connection between hunters and their dogs. The people at Sport Dog know that having a well-trained hunting dog is more than just having a reliable partner. It's a commitment to their safety and unlocking their full potential. The Sport Dog promise to customers is simple: gear the way you design it. Every product Sport Dog builds is meticulously designed and rigorously tested in the field, ensuring it withstands the toughest conditions you and your dog may encounter. Trust Sport Dog, where innovation meets passion, to elevate your hunting experience and strengthen the bond with your local companion. Using tracking equipment on my squirrel and coon dogs is extremely important to me. To track my squirrel dogs and my one old coon dog that's not very good. Get 20% off your first purchase using the code BEARGREASE. Go to www.sportdog.com/BEARGREASE to learn more.
Hey, just for the world to know, I recognize that I'm not a great singer, so but I just, the passion's just too strong to keep it all in.
Make a joyful noise.
Just I just got to let her go. Yep. So, yeah, The Ballad of an Ozark Man. There's some good lyrics in there,
It's good.
It tells the story. It tells the story.
It should tell a story.
A Word Promise was an Ozark man.
A good
song. Fried deer meat in a cast iron pan.
A good song should play a little movie in your head when you're listening to it.
Yes, and that it should. Did.
My favorite verse is, he went and got Eugene, and they found 28 points that would hang a wedding ring.
I like it.
Because the deer actually only officially scored 26 points. 26 scorable points. Mm-hmm. But by hanging
Arkansas,
a wedding ring on
there
it,
you go.
It'll score 28, because that's what Ori Province always said.
Yeah.
He called it a 28-point buck.
Now, the difference is Boone and Crockett recognizes anything over 1 inch.
1 inch.
Yep.
Well,
yep.
But listen to this.
Uh-huh. Okay.
This is where it gets deep real and gets there quick. Is that and this is getting serious quick, too.
Uh-oh.
The dream that I had in 2007, and the picture's right over on that wall.
Yeah.
I'll put the picture on Instagram. I had a dream that I killed a 24-point buck with a bow. And that year, I killed a buck that by Boone and Crockett standards had 21 points.
Yeah.
But by hanging a ring, it has 24 points. And that, you just have to deal with that if you don't believe it.
Do you feel like God is not Boone and Crockett certified? Is that what you're saying?
It's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying these are the facts. These are the facts. What did y'all think of the Oralee Province story?
I love it.
What'd you love about it, Misty?
Well, I think that I love this story because I remember when it happened. You took Shep with you on that trip. And I think probably the reason I loved it is a little different than the reason all the hunters are, but it's like a personal connection to the story and what that produced. How old was Shep when you took him?
He was just a little guy, wasn't he?
He was squeaky voice little.
He was 11. I think he was 11 years
old.
Was
he only 11?
Well, I mean, it was in 2019. I mean, I know almost the exact date. It was March of 2019.
He looks so little in that picture.
Yeah, a lot happens went from 11 to 14, though.
Yeah. Well, he's. I remember that year at school, they were learning about World War II. Uh-huh. And they said something about when it ended, and Shep knew immediately. He was like 45, I think, and he was like, I know it ended. He argued with someone about when it ended, but he knew the story because of sitting in that room.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was just sitting in the room.
That's good.
And to me, I just thought this is a great way. Like, what a wonderful tradition to hear oral history, and that it made. You know, it really demonstrated the value of oral history and of having young people make connections with older people and hear their stories, because it helps them piece together the world. Because like you said at the end, time moves faster than you realize. And Shep will have, you know, that history in his life, and he'll be able to tell that history to a generation, you know, Lord willing, a generation that is has the same spread in terms of on the other end than him. And that's how we know our people. That's how we know our stories. That's how we know our history. I just think it's so valuable, and that was such a special experience for our family.
Yeah,
Misty, I totally agree with you. There's something that I've always, since I was little, I was fortunate enough to know all my great grandparents on my mother's side,
mm-hmm.
and one of my great grandfathers immigrated from Europe And he would tell me he was 17 in 1915, and he would tell me stories of when he came to the U.S. through Ellis Island.
Oh,
and
I remember I thought he came through the land bridge.
And I remember how impacting those stories were, and listening to Mr. Ori, it had that same flavor, and it's like you latch onto those things, and you know, the simplicity with which he lived his life. And, you know, I was thinking about, as he was talking, in my mind, the phrase, simplicity is stability. You know, to think about, they had nothing, but they were stable, you know, and there's a stability that comes with a simple life that Mr. Ori was able to communicate. And just a beautiful, it's a beautiful thing to listen to that oral history.
Yeah.
My grandfather was born in 1913 on my mama's side. And he told me the difference in the Depression was that they didn't know they was in one until everybody shouted, hooray, we're out of it. And they're like, well, this is like last Wednesday. So they were eating what they grew, what they hunted, you know, what they raised and everything. And it just wasn't no, the bank was, you know, in the kitchen cabinet where if they got money for selling something, hides or furs or vegetables or whatever, you know, they put it in a can, a coffee can in the cabinet.
Yeah.
Other than that, you know, they didn't know what was going on. And it's very similar to what I loved when he said, we had plenty to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, everybody did. Yeah. It may have been, you know, in my grandfather's case, you know, they was catching possums and rendering them out. I mean, feeding them out and then eating them.
Yeah.
But it was also whatever, but he said, oh, we had plenty to eat.
Yeah.
Like, that was silly.
Yeah, yeah. It was almost like he was like, that's a dumb question.
Yeah, it was a non-event.
Dad, what did you think about it?
Well, he reminded me of Roy. Was it Roy Clark from Tennessee?
Yeah.
You know, I kept taking both of their lives and kind of like going, they're so similar, you know, and the way they talk, I mean, I just love that dialect. It's just beautiful to listen to. And of course, he had a simple life, but to kill what he killed in basically a week or two, you know, it's just pretty phenomenal. And so I spent my whole time thinking about luck. What is luck? I mean, you know, so I kind of focused on.
What did you think?
The underlying behind it. What do I think about?
Yeah, take us into your thoughts on that.
Well, I don't think it's luck, man. I mean, I think I've got a friend that I called him before I got up here. I got a friend that's hit 13 hole-in-ones on a golf course. 13. Jimmy Sears. You know Jimmy.
Are
you
serious?
And I called Jimmy. I said, Jimmy, was it 9, 13? How many? He said, it's 13. And I said, did you have any streaks where you did two or three in a row? He said, no, I never did more than one in a year. Of course, he's my age. We're the same age. So he'd been playing golf a lot of years. And so I said, well, you play 220 times a year. There's usually an average of four par threes on an 18-hole course. I first said, Jimmy, you had 600 shots a year at a hole-in-one.
With a par three?
And he said,
so you're
no.
You're saying only a par three?
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to get a hole in one on a par four or par five.
Gotcha.
He said, no, there's like four. He said, I had about 400, 800 shots a year to make those. And his good buddy, who's also a good buddy of mine, is not that good of a golfer. And he said he's had one or two just blind luck, you know. He's not a good golfer. And he still, because he played a lot. But Jimmy plays 220 times a year. So, I mean, if he wasn't good, he probably would have had three or four hole-in-ones. Well, but he's really, really, he's one of the top senior golfers in the state of Arkansas.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
I remember.
So, relate it to Ori.
So Ori, he's in the woods a lot. He's good with his gun. Holy cow, shooting a running buck. Yeah. You got to be kidding me.
Nine times. He must have had an AR-15.
I mean, no, what rifle back then was shooting, had nine rounds.
I don't know
it.
How he loaded. That's just what he told me.
You know, I would have never probably shot at the deer. I would have gone, wow, what a buck. You know, I mean, so he had the wherewithal to, I mean,
Back in the day, you had to shoot it because you couldn't take a picture of it with your iPhone.
So where Jimmy's really good with a club and a ball, you know, or he's good with a gun, he knows how to hunt, he's in the woods a lot, he's doing all this stuff, he created his own look. Now, once that opportunity, that's the key thing, is opportunity. He saw an opportunity, he took advantage of the opportunity, and he was skilled and ready. I mean, I would never have hit the deer. I would have been in a panic. I wouldn't have even had time to, what I'm saying?
Well, there's an old saying in golf, and I've seen it attributed to 15 different people. But the more you practice, the luckier you'll get. I know you've heard that. Which means the more you do something,
just a better chance.
You put yourself in the right spot.
So to me, what I came up with, and a lot of this, I don't know, it's not original thinking probably, but luck is kind of like the definition. I heard you say the definition of luck.
Right.
It's almost like a little story I read where a guy said he was in New York City, he was 60 years old, he had a business, he wanted to sell it. And he heard a guy say, "Mr. Buffett." And this guy goes, "Ching, ching, Buffett, New York City?" And he said, I walked over and I said, "Are you Warren Buffett?" And the guy said, "Yeah." He said, "I got a business I'm trying to sell. I think you'd like to hear the deal." Eventually, he sells the guy, Warren Buffett, this business. I mean, so that was luck. He heard the name.
He just happened to be
but
there.
Then
there was no skill involved in
right,
him being
but then
standing
he
there.
Had... He had the wherewithal to say, "Here's an opportunity. I'll never have it again," and he took advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. And the capacity to pitch something.
Yeah, and
well
he had the ability.
He would listen to him,
and he had a product, that was really, really good. So there was a little luck that deer came by. I mean, no question, but still, he was there. He was equipped. He was ready. He took advantage of it.
I'm gonna play devil's advocate.
Okay,
I'm gonna completely disagree with Gary, because I think that could be said if Ori Province had killed those deer when he was 60. But according to when he said he was born, he was 28 years old.
He was 38.
38 years old. Yeah. How many years have you hunted?
Well, I'm,
I mean, you're in the woods. You're in the woods a lot. You're in the woods a lot, right?
33
How many
years
180?
I mean, I'm 42.
How
so
many 180 inch deer have you killed? And I mean, you're hunting the same territory, and our deer numbers are greater than what they were back then.
Right.
So there had to be something, because I mean, there are skilled hunters that we know who hunt hard, who won't ever even see a deer that big.
That was the only part of it that. If you were making a case to an unbiased jury, not from this planet, that didn't understand luck or anything, is you would say this man was very prepared, he was very diligent, he was very skilled, he'd put in his time, but the size of these deer was wild, especially when you understand age structures of whitetails, because let's just say those were 6.5-year-old deer, 5.5-year-old deer, which is the old deer. The chance of that could have translated into just like a nice 8-point. I mean, I think one of the oldest deer I ever killed is about 115 inch 8-point over there with big old heavy bases. And he was just a brute and just an old, I felt like he was an old deer, but he just had like a little scrubby set of horns. And the fact that twice he killed an older age class deer that carried that kind of stuff, that's what was wild. Now, if he'd have just, because I tried to make this analogy inside the podcast, was that year he may have killed 2 5.5-year-old deer that were 135 inch 8-points, which would have been more common. Gary.
I agree with what Josh is saying, except for one thing. Ori was looking for a deer.
Yeah.
You know, the guy that sold his business to Warren Buffett just heard the name Buffett. I mean, you know, if he'd have just been walking around with his gun, just looking and go, "Oh, there's a big deer." You know, he was looking for deer. So I more agree with you than some of the stuff I'm saying. But
so
the fact was, he was looking for that deer.
Right.
I would ask that guy if his name was Jimmy.
Jimmy I think Buffett. The question
is that would be your response. That's what to I was hearing,
Are you Jimmy?
Are you Jimmy?
I think the question isn't, was it luck? I think the greater question is, what is luck?
Right.
You know what I mean? Because really clearly there was some kind of favor there.
The question, I use the term luck. Isaac and I talked about this before. I might use the term luck just so people understand what I'm talking about. I really don't believe in luck. I mean, I use that term because we all can identify. When I say luck, you're like, oh, I know what you're talking about. But that was the whole point of my thing is what is luck? And is there, because I tried to make it clear is that there's when you root it down to the very foundational position, there's a split in the road when you start to define luck and its origin. And one is this naturalistic approach that it's just chance. And then the other one would be a supernatural why in the road of there's something outside of this place orchestrating things to happen to people that are beyond their control for a specific reason.
I mean, that is by definition providence.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the difference between providence and luck.
Really? Okay. Do you have the definition of providence? See, yeah. I wouldn't even really have caught that.
I take Isaac so much more serious with this outfit on.
Well, I've got to stop wearing gym shorts and the protective care of a god or of nature as a spiritual power, god or nature as providing protective or spiritual care, timely preparation for future eventualities.
Okay, providence.
Yeah.
So really, that's what that's what we were talking about. It was luck or providence.
Yeah, not province.
And then last name.
But also, you're introducing. Providence.
That's why the title
now,
works.
Now Clay gets
province
it.
Or providence.
Now he wishes he would have gone with it and paid attention.
Well, I didn't text him back until 7 p.m., which is after
Isaac
the deadline. Anyway,
always has really deep, catchy titles for stuff. That I don't get for a minute or two.
And then it's after the deadline?
Well, it's after I immediately respond back, I don't get it. And then I realize it's really good.
There's two styles. It's either that or just empirically bad. And you go not that. But that inspired the actual title.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a median guy. I'm one extreme or the other.
But I think you kind of actually got three things. You don't just have luck and providence. You've also got this real strong, and Gary's bringing that in, and several of the guys who talked are bringing that in. Also, merit. This is just, luck.
It totally strikes me as a false dichotomy.
Yeah, there's three different things that you're really examining here. Was this luck? Was this the...
Y'all think we should go back and just erase the podcast?
No, but it's okay.
We can make it look like an accident. Where's episode 62?
Our account got hacked.
I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Luck, providence, or is this a result of hard work?
Total justification.
Yeah, is this he because of his hard
he
work,
earned it.
He right. was
yeah.
there.
Yeah, there you
and
go.
And so it was merit. And I think that is the narrative that fits best inside of the American psyche. That's kind of more... how we think about the world. That's
he paid his dues, and so he had this one coming.
Because of his hard work, this happened.
Yeah.
That's our rugged individualistic value system, is that people get what they reap what they sow, and he did good things, and he's reaping the benefit of it.
Yeah.
And so that's this third thing over here. And I think what you're talking about with that buck right there, the biggest one you ever killed, That was not merit. That was there was something way more to it than that.
Well,
and so you're seeing it through that lens. And I think there's other cultures who would definitely not ever think that they would never put merit in there as a piece of this is why this happened. They would always see it as providence.
Yeah. But I think
all of the above.
It's fundamentally both, because if you had had that dream but you had never shot a bow.
Right.
That's nothing, right?
Pause. Or would he have had the dream if he never shot a bow?
Oh, no.
Oh,
yeah.
We got a real... dadgummit. We got a real Schrodinger's buck over here.
Oh, man, Isaac.
I don't even know what that means.
Hold on there, cowboy boots.
I put on my cowboy boots and all of a sudden I've got million-dollar words. No, but seriously, a great example is if Ori Province was born 20 years earlier, what stuck at what... neon words when you were interviewing him, he's like, I walk 20, 25 miles a day. You guys, you ever walk 20 or 25 miles a day regularly?
At gunpoint.
Like,
yeah.
I can do that, but it is brutal. And so it's like he fundamentally put in some work, right?
Yeah.
But if he was born 20 years earlier, it wouldn't have mattered if he walked 20 or 25 miles a day because there were no deer.
No deer.
Literally no deer.
Yeah. It wouldn't have mattered a lick. And so, like, I cannot separate the two. I think that there's providence. Yeah, I don't subscribe to the idea of blind luck. But I wouldn't, that's not a mountain I'd die on. I think there's providence, and then I think there's merit, and I think that he had both of those things going.
And that's kind of what I was saying when I said sometimes people want to just grab hold of one thing or the other.
Yeah.
Just like,
yeah,
it's all chance.
Yeah.
It's all chance. There's nothing but chance in the universe.
Yeah.
And, or someone say the other side of it, which would be like every minuscule thing, the Brent's chair just squeaked. Because, you know,
X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like there's like have every deer that I've killed, have I felt like it was like life changing, monumental?
That wasn't my chair.
That was Brent's chair. No, did that deer change my life?
Yeah.
There's no one on this earth that will ever convince me otherwise. It really did.
Yeah.
And so was that deer important? Was that deer did something from another place?
Yeah. I think we need to talk about that deer a little bit more.
Sure.
I think we need to, and I think we need to talk about, especially if you're going to put the picture on Instagram, there's some side text on the picture.
Yeah, there's a note on there.
That we probably need to explain. And I will say, when you brought that deer back, Ava, Josh's youngest daughter, was here.
Oh, yeah. Josh's daughter was here.
Forgot about that.
And Bear was here. And
she would have been little.
They were tiny babies. They were big old fat cheek babies. And they both, we've got pictures of both of those two, Bear and Ava. Standing over it, they're in their PJs, and their little fat cheeks are just sitting there smiling at it, not having any idea
2007.
What it represented.
All right, give us the story.
Wait a minute.
Well,
deer.
He kind of told you.
Well,
no.
You were going to say.
Well, I was just saying. I think that you know, you're kind of bringing that in, and I thought the way you brought that in at the end was sort of underwhelming. It was kind of a big, huge deal. Maybe it's because of the impact it's had on us, but I thought it was a little bit
like I didn't do a good job.
I'm not saying you
I just
didn't,
do
didn't a good
want to. I didn't want to
turn it into the Clay Newcomb
story.
Yeah.
I didn't want to make, but I wanted to throw it out there. Like,
yeah,
this is
you
stuff
had this
that happens
dream
to people,
and you drew it out, and you put a note
in
on there.
In July, I think it says July 2007. I'll look at it, and I saw the buck, and I woke up, and I drew pictures of it. And the buck that I drew has really long, curved brow tines. It's got a burr point, and it's got kickers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at that buck and look at the buck I killed,
it's crazy.
They look a lot alike.
Yeah.
And I wrote a note on the sketch. I said, "Do not throw away Misty."
Like, was there a comma there?
Well,
no, there is no comma. So he is talking. She's the direct object.
I knew what would happen is I drew it, and then I didn't really have a place to put the sketch, or at the time I didn't. And so I just knew it was just going to be like laying around like on my bedstand.
Clay would write down incredibly important phone numbers or confirmation numbers and just set them down and then be like, why did you throw that away? And it's like, it was literally on
a
piece
of torn up. It's the definition of trash.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I framed the sketch, and then there's a cutout. There's a picture of the deer in this little frame. But
and writing about that is one of the things that jump started your.
Oh, it was the only thing. I never even thought about writing an article or going into the outdoor industry at all.
Right.
Just killed a big deer.
Yep.
And I was like, man, it'd be pretty cool to write a story about it because there was an angle that I had on the story from a tactical sense. I actually really used a lot. I mean, I hunted the deer 15 mornings. At the time, I could only hunt in the morning, and so I hunted mornings. The only days I didn't hunt was I went down to your deer camp, Dad. So I killed the deer on October the 18th. I spent 3 mornings at your deer camp. So 15 straight mornings I hunted for that deer and killed him on the 18th. And this was before we had trail cameras and stuff. So I had seen the deer with my own eyes one time in this spot and ended up hunting there. And I rattled him in on a balmy, windy, like 72 degree morning on October 18th.
But you had the dream when?
July of 2007. Killed
so
it in
three
October
months before,
in 2007.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's like, you know, like you can say I'm not trying to make the dichotomy here, but like to illustrate the point that it's both is like you hunted 15 straight mornings.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like you didn't go out October 1st and like plug it and go.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there was some work involved. Dad,
did you, I think I know the answer to this, but did you ever see that deer or, you know?
Yeah. Could that have
related to your dream at all?
Oh, well, I videoed the deer in late August.
But you didn't see it in July.
Before the dream.
I never knew the deer was alive until two months after
the antlers wouldn't have looked like that in July of 2007.
Well, you're right.
And the next thing is...
The first time I saw the deer was... actually, the first time I saw that deer was like September the 8th or 9th of 2007.
So let's get the timeline. I think it's helpful for listeners.
All right.
July, you have the dream.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
August.
I remember waking up and it was a big bright morning and I was going out to get hot. That's all I remember. I was going to work.
Yeah. August. So that's not helpful for the timeline. I'm just
relating what I see in my mind. I remember waking up.
Just a little color commentary.
We just need yes or no, sir.
Just bare details just for the listeners to have a clear.
Dear details.
All right. So, yeah. All right. So July,
see
you have the
two
dream.
Hands?
Oh, man.
I used to work with these two hands.
July, you have the dream.
Now I write songs.
August. Okay, deer. August, you see the deer. Does the deer look like the deer you saw in the dream in August?
Oh, I never made the connection.
Okay. You kill the deer
in October.
I never
made the connection until like long after I even killed the deer. Like it wasn't like I was
That's
like...
That's impressive in other ways.
It wasn't...
I don't think that's a compliment.
I'm just kidding.
I mean, I don't remember how long.
Yeah.
But I mean, it wasn't like I shot the deer and I was like, that was the deer in the dream. Like, it was sometime after I was like, man, I drew a picture.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that, you know, like, I almost didn't draw the picture.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I was like, I'm going to kill a deer this year.
Yeah.
It was just like, I had a dream. It was really clear, vivid. Impacting.
You felt like it was significant when you woke up.
Yeah, yeah. I remember more about the dream. I could tell.
I remember more about the dream, too.
Yeah.
Because I remember you talking to me about it. Because I was like, what's this?
And,
Misty, don't throw away.
But
don't throw away Misty. Yeah.
So it was sometime after that I realized it. But
I think that's your next song title. Don't throw away Misty.
Don't throw away Misty.
I'd like to hear ballad. That's a good ballad right there.
The ballad of the... I call that book Dagger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I got something to say about what Mo Shepherd was saying about getting loaded up and going over to see it. Like, I'm not here to say, like, technology is the downfall of human civilization or whatever, but, like, it made me, like, it immediately took me to the Floatin' Tote in El Dorado Springs, Missouri, where we'd go check in our deer, and everybody'd go post up there. The Floatin' Tote. You'd pull in your truck, and all of a sudden, everybody'd come over, start looking over the bed.
Oh, yeah.
You just couldn't, if you got anything halfway decent, you couldn't wait to get down there and just talk about it and see what everybody had
so
going on.
So you were
on.
Saying like, Mo's dad would have just looked on Facebook
rather than gone to
Ori's house.
Yeah.
Ori would have texted him and said, hey, I killed a big deer. Congrats.
There's just something magical about like being there in person, like that community connection of like going over and seeing it and you know, feeling proud
your
about
hands
it.
On it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isaac's describing social capital.
Social capital
Talk
is what
to
I
me,
was describing.
It's I mean he's what he's talking about is the networks that people form and how those create identity. They create resources. When economists look at the world and they look at human capital, they look at economic resources to evaluate nations, to evaluate communities. But these social scientists came up with this other term in the mid to late 90s called social capital. And it's how people are connected to each other. And it actually came up earlier than that, but it got popularized in the mid 90s. But that those connections actually provide a resource to that community that is as valuable as the economic connections. And they look at this in terms of marriage. They look at this in terms of voting patterns, the way they evaluate whether there's social capital in a community. And it's been in pretty much steady decline since the middle part.
Okay.
I mean,
that's fascinating. That nails it with what Isaac's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Social capital is like having gold coins. Social media is like using credit cards.
No. Social media is like those chocolate gold coins.
Exactly.
Like, okay. There's something there. A little hit of dopamine.
I never saw Ori Province without a pair of overalls on that didn't make it in the song. I tried to find overalls.
Oh, that
it didn't happen.
I felt it.
You felt his overalls?
Yeah, I felt like this man was.
Yeah, for real. Like, I don't know that he was like
what,
Brent.
What kind of footwear did he wear?
I bet it wasn't Crocs.
That's a good question.
Tevas. He was a Teva man.
He was more of a Jocko's guy.
You know, I saw him just wear kind of like just brown leather lace-up boots.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you the
I
couldn't tell you the brand.
Here's another question on the front of social media. I feel like because today it's so prevalent, I had this like incongruence in my mind of like only wanting to shoot big deer because I want to post them on social media so I can get validation in that way, right? And so like shooting big deer is tied to my self-worth. And so like
so you
feeling
just,
weird
you just
and
decided to grow your hair out.
I'm looking for social validation in, or external validation in any way. But like this idea, like when I listened to it, it didn't sound like there was some disappointment that he peaked early as a hunter or something like that. It's like the end goal was not like killing the biggest deer, but it was just going and killing deer and enjoying being in the woods and enjoying hunting.
Yeah.
And like when I listen to that, I go like, man, that's really cool to have like killed two arguably world-class deer in the span of 2 weeks, early on in your hunting career.
Yeah.
And not to, like, carry resentment or a grudge about, like...
Yeah, they didn't... They were meat hunting. They wanted... They liked killing big deer.
Sure.
But, like, he would have killed a basket rack 8-point just as fast as he would have killed one of those other deer. And I think that would have been really common back in those that period of time.
James Lawrence killed his biggest deer in the 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, the first deer he ever killed.
So, you know, you look at that, and there weren't as many hunters.
Yep.
Those big deer were out there because they weren't getting hunted as much.
Yep.
And you know, Lawrence's family, they were hunting over here where the deer sign was. And James was going where the uneducated guy would go.
Yeah,
he was doing stupid stuff. He kills this huge buck. And a lot of times you'll see stories where a little kid, this 12-year-old kid's killed a 190-point buck, you know, whatever, buck. Well, the reason that happened is because his uncles said, hey, little kid don't know what he's doing. Put him down there where old Junior used to sit for years and never saw a deer.
Yeah.
Let's get the good stands for us guys that know how to kill them. Well, they send him down there, and guess what?
Yeah.
He kills the big buck because the big bucks don't run where I hunt. I guarantee you, I know they don't. I don't want to kill. I don't want to kill a big buck. You got to sit. It's too hard. I mean, I want to sit where a bunch of activity's going on.
Well, like tying right into that, like they just and tying into luck, they just had what was the guy's name? Dustin Huff was that his name on the Meat Eater podcast.
Yeah.
And they got down a rabbit hole of talking about how many people kill big deer the first time they sit somewhere. He killed.
Yeah.
The record for, is it America, United States?
It's the United States, biggest typical.
And it was the first time he'd sat in that stand. And it was just like, oh, that I guess that makes sense. That educated buck is going to get wise.
Hey, there's the second step to that you never hear is that no one else is sitting that stand either in a long time.
Yeah.
So that buck is there because if you're smart, you don't hunt there. You're going to hunt a scrape or a rub over here.
And that buck is smart and says,
and
I know where the people go.
I'm going to be over here.
Well, hey, I talked with the whitetail deer biologist for the state of Arkansas to get some of the data on that reintroduction of deer. And I spoke with him, and he said the same thing. He said in the 1960s, There were actually more deer in the 1960s than probably I thought there would have been. 30 deer per square mile is actually a decent amount of deer. And in some places, there were 30 deer per square mile. Maybe not that deep in the mountains where Ori was at because it's just rough, full canopy stuff. But he said the same thing. He said there just weren't a lot of people out there hunting. And so there were bucks that were getting old. And so, yeah, there's something to be said there. And I guarantee you, and I haven't looked at the weather patterns during that time, but I have followed the Mountain Man Big Buck contest for about 20-plus years. And on years like this year, I guarantee you, probably.
I guarantee you, probably.
Maybe, it's possible.
Highly likely.
100% guarantee you that the deer are going to be of less quality on a really dry, droughty year because the nutrition of these animals coming into the summer, mm-hmm. the nutrition they have, but antler growth is also connected to how they did last fall. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things connected to antler growth, but
connected
probably,
to the mom's nutrition when the deer was in the womb.
Yeah, it's connected to a lot of stuff, but it is seasonal. Like on a dry year, like there's usually a mountain man. Usually there's like one deer that might net Boone and Crockett, and that's a 4-county area in Northwest Arkansas. Maybe 1-2 deer net Boone and Crockett. The year that I killed my big buck in 2007.
Proud of you.
Thank you. There were 2 deer that netted Boone and Crockett.
Yeah.
That hung on the wall because I took my buck to the Mountain Man Big Buck contest.
Yeah, you did.
Of course I did.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, in 1960, those deer weren't near as smart as they are now.
Right, not as much pressure.
I mean, you know, these deer just said, okay, I'm going to walk below this bluff, you know, this is the cool way to walk. Well, they're not going to do that today. And if you go to those same mountains.
That's the way deer talk, too.
You know, if you go to the same area, you're probably not going to find that big a buck in there.
Right.
That deer would have gotten, if he were living in the last 10 years.
He got killed when he was 2.
Yeah, he got killed when he was about 3 or 4 years old, you know what I mean? So
and that's, there's a lot of people that hunt in that part of the world now, for sure. Yeah.
So luck. You know, I still don't really understand the luck part, but he was a little lucky. But
well, and you know, and Mo Shepherd, who is today one of the best deer hunters I know for that part of the world, just big woods, deep public land hunting. And Mo's never killed 170, 180 inch deer, and he's killed a lot of deer and a lot of old deer, and that is just luck of the draw on, like. Mo is hunting as big and old a deer as there are out there and killing them. And they usually have about 130, 140 inch racks. You know, the odd one's going to be up in the 150s. And that's just pretty standard. And there are these outliers that do happen. And, it's pretty unique. Pretty unique. But I think what I was getting at is that our understanding of how the world works influences our decisions, you know. But
oh, yeah.
I do believe that we bank on street, whatever you want to call it, I'm going to call it luck just because just we bank on unmerited favor coming to us.
We do.
I mean, and actually the human, I thought about this since the podcast. Let's erase this podcast and do it again, Isaac.
I think it's a good podcast.
Listen, the human metabolism is built upon the potential for fortuitous streaks of luck. We literally like are designed to gorge ourselves at times, and our bodies store fat for when the next day and the day after that and the day after that we can't find a fruit tree full of fruit, or we don't make a kill. And that's the reason that the majority of Americans are obese, is because we get lucky every day when it comes to food
then
in 2020.
Good streak of luck.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I know,
I mean,
exactly
because
what you're saying.
Sometimes it's like, we're just not designed to have a gourmet meal every single meal of every single day of our life. We're built to have some good fortune at times and some lean times at times. And it all kind of evens out in the end.
Here's another interesting thing that I thought of while Tony Peterson was talking about is this idea of placebos. Because he was talking about psyching yourself up, right?
Yeah,
you're doing something
point,
mentally.
Yeah.
A placebo has a measurable effect, which is crazy. For everybody who doesn't know, a placebo is like a...
Man, those cowboy boots just changed his life.
I know.
He's like the smartest guy in the room. Yeah.
No. They changed your life. I've been the same guy the whole time.
The leg tattoo guy I knew before.
I've been the same guy the whole time. You just were casting aspersions on me because of my appearance.
I don't even know where
the aspersion
is.
A placebo is like a... I don't know how to define
it's
it.
A control.
It's a sugar pill. It's a control. And so, like, it has a measurable effect. So you can be given a non-medication, and it makes you better, potentially.
Given a sugar pill instead of actual medication.
And what's even...
And you get better.
And you get better still.
And what's crazier than that is it is also a measurable effect if you know it's a placebo.
Even
which
if
is,
you know.
Like, mind-boggling. I don't know what to what degree it is, but it's just, like, the human brain has... Or the human body or the human spirit or whatever it is has an amazing ability to impact real outcomes.
That's good. That's good, Isaac.
One day, I did it.
One day you may run this podcast.
I did it this year. I posted on social media, felt cute, might kill a big deer later. What did I do?
Killed a big one.
30 minutes later, I killed a gross 161.
That's a big 8 point. One day they made... Do a story about your
streak. One day they may induct me into the Bear Grease Hall of Fame. Wait, you know, is Clay getting inducted?
He's got a lot of years of proven character to
I thought it was interesting, like, when I go, like, hunting or if I go fishing and I, like, there's this sense of catching a big fish, I always try to think, well, I'm not going to catch a big fish today.
Oh, yes.
Or I'm not going to kill a deer today.
Managing expectations.
Almost this sense of if I do, it's this bonus.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a good time.
And if I don't, I won't be disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I never stepped to the plate. I don't think I ain't fishing to hit it out of the park.
Really?
Really. Yeah.
Every time.
I'm very much more.
It's just one crash of expectation after another.
I'm always hitting homers, Jack.
High expectations and high results. Yeah, I'm definitely in the Josh Spielmaker camp of mitigating expectations.
You've heard of the Casey Shreve says that my what is it called on your gravestone?
Epitaph.
Will be manage expectations.
Wow.
Excellent. Well, I really enjoyed this podcast. And for people that would have been following along on the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast, they would have heard the full interview. So actually, it would be like a bonus episode if you wanted to hear
it's really good.
An unedited full version. I talked to Mr. Ori for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So on this podcast, there was 21 minutes. So there's actually a lot more.
Yeah.
And
it's good, too.
It's just...
It is.
It's totally unedited. So it's us, like, talking about the weather, us, you know, kind of doing stuff. But it was good. There was a lot on it. His wife came on and talked and told how she puts up corn and how she cooks deer meat. And she told about her grandchildren. You know, my favorite parts of these podcasts, my favorite part of that whole episode was the very beginning, well, close to the beginning, when you hear the screen door open.
Yeah.
And Mr. Ori goes, "Hey, Clay, how you doing?" And then I talk to him, and then his wife comes in, and she says, "Oh, excuse the house. Yep. I just was going to vacuum, and I didn't want to do it." And then
you could add a sandwich off that floor.
Yeah. Well, it just kind of, I don't know, if you've been there, you just know those people.
Yeah.
And it kind of tells the story. And, he was a relic of a man. And I continue to be amazed and tried to make the point on the podcast that every generation has a touch point with a much older generation that they think are like the real deal.
Yeah.
Like when I look at Ori Province and Lewin Newcomb, my grandfather, and guys that aren't here anymore.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, they were the real old timers. Like when I look at Dad, like Dad's not an old timer. I mean, like, you know, to me, you're 75 and but it's because we're 74.
We're
pretty close in age.
Give them the year.
But to my kids, they'll talk about their granddad and be like, "Golly, he was born in like 1773," or you know. But my point is that everybody. I actually talked to Brooks Blevins about this one time, the Ozark historian, academic guy, Dr. Brooks Blevins. And he said every single generation has, for a period of time, the oldest possible people that they could interact with. And those guys always have something very different and a very different life experience than you. And so they're really intriguing. But there was a time when Ori Province was like on the pop culture cutting edge of time when he was 18 years old. And the old timers to him
were born in the 1830s.
Right.
That was my point inside of that. It's kind of mind-boggling. Yeah. And Daniel Boone would have one time just been like the dude driving down the road, driving a, you know, 2019 Chevy Silverado four-wheel drive with a couple mules in the back. You know, he just would have been like a normal guy.
Yeah.
And he would have interacted with people.
Because most normal people carry around mules
with a stock trailer. With a stock trailer in the back. No trailer. That's where I'm headed. Point being, you can't imagine Daniel Boone looking back in history and going, man, the old timers. But he was just like us.
Yeah.
Just like us. You know,
Daniel Boone was like two people back, three people back. I mean, he's not that far. Lincoln is not that far back from us, really.
Right.
You know, you go back to Jesus Christ, 20 people. I mean, I figured it before. When you were a kid, we probably talked about it.
Yeah.
You know, you just go back. I had an old buddy that was in his 90s, and I'm thinking, okay, he's born here. You know, if he knew somebody back, you know.
Yeah.
And you start tumbling that back, and, I mean, it's really, Lincoln and I are about the same age, you know.
Yeah.
You get to
thinking about it. In the big picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For real.
The last, the last widow of a Civil War veteran died in 2020.
What?
Yeah. At 101, she got married when she was young and he was old, and then she lived to 101.
Wow.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Isaac's one day going to run Bear Grease.
They know because she was still drawing his pension, which was like $7 or something like that.
Wow. In
Confederate dollars?
Man, I hope not.
I'm just trying to figure out.
There's a crypto.
It was in crypto.
I don't buy it.
You don't buy what?
The last widow. Come on, widow,
Isaac. Yep.
Don't doubt Isaac Neal.
So what year did they get married?
No,
she,
I read
at
I
age 17, told. Married 93-year-old widower James Bolin.
Pause.
Oh,
she was digging for that money. She married him not during the Civil War.
She was a Civil War veteran.
We call her a gold digger. That's fascinating. We need to do a
In 2020?
Podcast.
2020, December 16th.
Wow.
Marshfield, Missouri.
Whoa.
Are you serious?
That's where my wife's from.
No
that's
way.
Right by Springfield.
That's unfortunate that there weren't some conversations there.
Look. Wow. That was a great
lost
place to end, Isaac.
That's a new tattoo right there.
Yeah.
Queen of Marshfield.
Would you be interested in getting a back tattoo of the Bear Grease Hall of Fame members.
There's our
perpetual plaque.
You have to come in here shirtless.
I'll take it under consideration.
every time we add someone to it, he has to get a tattoo.
What if you got the tattoos and I was like, man, Isaac, you're fired.
Yeah, we might need a longer contract.
Would you have to have something removed to put it on there?
No. I got plenty of real estate.
I think he should maybe legs, you know.
They're full, Misty.
Well, I mean, he could remove stuff. But
back to the legs?
You know, just keep, that way you could just keep
like
adding.
Like one list?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One list.
It could be but small.
You could have it drawn like a scroll.
Yeah.
Well,
that'd be awesome.
And I could be holding it like this.
Yeah. Full size.
Looking.
You should get a life-size tattoo of Clay,
guys.
Only bigger.
Fantastic. I love, there's some podcasts that just hit home for me. This one did. I liked it. Aside from all the whitetail tactic stuff we talked about, which I mean, the main part that really hit home was the Ori stuff. But having Mark Kenyon and Tony Peterson, those guys are good, man. They really are. They're colleagues of mine at Meteor have hunted with them. They're really good. And I did mention that this fall you'll get to see me and Mark Kenyon hunting public land in Arkansas, big mountain country, on a backcountry mule type hunt, which is pretty cool because that's kind of the way. I mean, it's, you know, same part of the world Ori was in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you can check that out.
Cool.
But, Dad, closing thoughts?
Just very interesting. Enjoyed it. I'm still looking for some luck to come my way.
Still waiting on that streak. Well, that's all. Keep the wild places wild.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.